Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
They're supposed to be going out to the site tomorrow to begin their investigation.
The Army investigates a helicopter crash near Healy that killed 3 soldiers. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 28th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, advocates and family members question a man's treatment after his death behind bars.
DOC often says that, you know, it's not solitary confinement, they're not in trouble, but they're living in conditions of confinement.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
3 soldiers were killed and another injured in a mid-air crash of 2 Army helicopters near Healy yesterday. 11th Airborne Division Chief of Media Relations John Pinnell says the Fort Wainwright-based 2-seater Apache helicopters were returning from a training mission in the Donnelly Training Area about 1:30 Thursday afternoon when they collided and crashed about 50 miles east of Healy.
The terrain is extremely rugged, mountainous, deep snow, heavily forested. It required helicopter access with hoists to get in there.
Pinnell says 2 soldiers were declared dead at the scene and a 3rd died en route to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. The injured soldier was transported to the hospital as well.
And is currently in stable condition.
Pinnell says the names of the soldiers killed in the crash are expected to be released tomorrow. He says there is not much information available about weather or other factors that might have contributed to the crash.
I have no idea at this point, but there's a safety investigation that will be ongoing by the Army's Combat Readiness Center out of Fort Novosel in Alabama. There's a team on the way up if they're not in state already, and they're supposed to be going out to the site tomorrow to begin their investigation. And until they have made the determination, there's just really no way that I can give you any kind of speculation.
This is the 2nd crash involving an 11th Airborne Division Apache helicopter in Alaska this year. In February, an Apache rolled on takeoff from the Talkeetna Airport, where it had stopped to refuel. 2 soldiers were treated for injuries. Candidate Al Gross shook up last year's special election for U.S. House when he withdrew from the race in June, citing personal reasons. The Alaska Division of Elections removed his name from the special general ballot but did not replace him. Today, the state Supreme Court confirmed that the Division of Elections made the right call. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
A lot about last year's special election was confusing, especially since it was the first one conducted by ranked choice vote. But the rule the Division of Elections invoked, a 64-day time limit for replacing candidates on the ballot, pre-existed Alaska's new voting system. If a candidate withdraws within 64 days of an election, no substitution is allowed. That's how the division saw it. So the agency decided not to advance 5th place finisher Tara Sweeney. A group of voters sued, citing their fundamental right to select their political representatives. The Supreme Court ruled against them. The court's opinion has no impact on the special election results, and it isn't a surprise. That's because the court issued a bare-bones ruling in June to the same effect, allowing the special general election to take place in August with only 3 names on the ballot. The 30-page opinion is the justices' efforts to explain their reasoning for that call. While they affirmed the decision not to put Sweeney on the ballot, the justices faulted the division for removing Gross's name. They said a strict interpretation of the 64-day window would have required election officials to leave his name in place, despite his withdrawal. It was slightly off point since the voters who filed the legal challenge didn't try to stop the removal of Gross's name, only the addition of Sweeney's. Mary Peltola ultimately won the special general. Her spot on the ballot wasn't at stake in this lawsuit. She came in fourth in the special primary behind Gross, but ahead of Sweeney. Peltola went on to win the regular election, too, and now holds Alaska's sole seat in the U.S. House. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Mark Cook Jr. is the third person to die in Alaska Department of Corrections custody this year. His family says he died by suicide after hanging himself at Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau, where they say he'd spent weeks in solitary confinement with debilitating back pain. He was 27 years old. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry spoke with his family and has this story. And a quick warning, the story contains descriptions of suicide.
In an intensive care unit at Bartlett Regional Hospital, Yadukwe Mark Cook Jr. was on life support Monday. He'd been declared dead, but he's an organ donor, so he remained hooked up to the machines. Cook's family sang a Tlingit entrance and exit song, often used for ceremonies. Some read scripture and prayers. Ernestine Hanlon Abel spoke to her grandson in his hospital bed.
We're going to do a song for you. This is to help you exit this physical world, and you are entering a new journey.
Mark's death fits a pattern. In a recent investigation, the Anchorage Daily News reported that suicides in Alaska jails spiked last year, and that the department has long faced criticism that it does not do enough to prevent suicides. These deaths were all among people who were awaiting trial. Hanlon Abel says her grandson was the best Tlingit dancer she's ever seen. But in February, he visited the Huna Health Clinic with a back injury and left with pain so bad he could barely walk. Cook's family says he got upset at the clinic, yelled, and threatened to sue. The next day, Huna police arrested him on misdemeanor charges of trespassing and property damage. Cook was later transferred to Lemon Creek because his family said he could not get the medical care he needed at the Huna jail. They said they were in touch with him throughout his time at Lemon Creek, and he didn't get much care there either. And family members say that because of his back problems, Cook was placed in conditions that amounted to solitary confinement about 3 weeks ago. Cook's father, Mark Cook Sr., said he spoke with an Alaska State trooper in the emergency room about what happened on April 22nd. According to Cook Sr., the trooper said that Cook used his bedsheets to hang himself from a vent after putting tape over the room's security camera, and that it was about 30 minutes before security found him.
This shouldn't have happened. That was cruel and unusual punishment in that jail. He taped up the camera.
Why didn't they untape it?
And they didn't find him for over half an hour after he went silent.
That other voice is Jody Schrock, Cook's mother. She believes his suicide was a result of untreated back pain and solitary confinement.
He couldn't handle the pain anymore. They just threw him in a cage and left him there. He never would have killed himself had he gotten help for what was wrong with him.
The troopers confirmed the manner of Cook's death, but referred KTOO to the Department of Corrections for details. The department did not answer questions about whether they followed their suicide prevention procedures. Megan Edge is with the American Civil Liberties Union in Alaska. She said her organization has heard from a number of people placed in what amounted to solitary confinement for medical reasons.
DOC often says that, you know, it's not solitary confinement. They're not in trouble, but they're living in conditions of confinement that are identical to solitary confinement.
Edge said solitary confinement is inhumane, and that the Department of Corrections hasn't explained why inmates with medical issues would face those conditions. A department spokesperson told KTOO that it, quote, does not practice true solitary confinement since most cells have two bunks, unquote, but declined to comment on whether Cook was kept separate from other inmates. Meanwhile, Cook's family thinks he should not have been in jail at all. Family members say they feel Cook's bail was unreasonably high for the offense, and they don't understand why a judge said Cook could not stay with his grandparents if he was released. Edge said it's important to remember that Cook had yet to go to trial for his case, which involved two misdemeanors. On Tuesday, at a Juno hotel, 10 of Cook's loved ones shared stories about who he was, often speaking of his giving spirit. In his 27 years, Cook was a father, an EMT, and a musician. Hanlon Abel said she hopes her grandson's choice to be an organ donor will mean that other families won't have to grieve for their child.
That's the way he was. He's gone and he's still giving.
Cook Sr. said hospital staff told him that up to a dozen people could benefit from his son's organ donations. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumery.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the committee managing Newtok's relocation meets for the first time in 2 years.
It creates a synergy that allows movement, and that's what Newtok needs when you get them moved.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sexual violence affects nearly every household in America. If someone you love has experienced sexual assault or abuse, it can be a lot to handle. Reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline today to learn how to support someone you care about. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
One of America's first climate change-driven community relocations is well underway. But until this week, the steering committee that's overseeing the project hadn't met for 2 years. As Emily Schwing reports, the Newtok Village Council held government-to-government meetings with federal officials and provided the community with a long-awaited update.
Della Carl is a Newtok Village Council member. She says this kind of meeting is overdue.
This coming back, it's going to keep everyone together and everyone will stay informed.
A mother of five, Carl lives in Mahtarvik, Newtok's new village site, 9 miles east across the Ninglik River.
I want to continue to feel like I'm helping my community to bring our community as one again, because this is all my family.
For decades, the permafrost under Newtok has been melting. As the climate warms, the ground under the village has become unstable and waterlogged. Houses are leaning, their walls are damp and moldy. Critical infrastructure is showing signs of severe and irreparable damage. The people who live here have to move. A team with the Bureau of Indian Affairs made a rare visit to Newtok by snow machine after meeting with tribal council members in Mahtarvik. They refused to answer questions about the visit. Those with knowledge say the BIA is treading carefully as it implements experimental and pilot projects through its tribal climate resilience branch. Jackie Catalina Schaefer is the director of climate initiatives for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
So coming out to a community and having a community meeting is so vitally important because it allows the communities to see the faces and the people who are working to advocate on their behalf.
Schaefer's been working closely on the relocation project for years.
When you gather, you reignite that relationship. This is so vitally important. And I can't, there is no price tag for it. It creates a synergy that allows movement, and that's what Newtok needs when you get them moved.
Last year, the Bureau of Indian Affairs named both Newtok and Napakiak as the recipients of two $25 million grants to help address the impacts of climate change. The funding is the first of its kind from the federal government. How it's used could set the stage for at least a dozen other Alaska Native villages across the state that are facing similar issues as a warming climate continues to alter the landscape. Jocelyn Fenton is the director of programs at the Denali Commission, a federal agency that provides support for infrastructure and utilities in rural Alaska.
What does $25 million really mean at the end of the day for a community that's facing what Newtok is facing?
It is a drop in the bucket, but we've learned that you have to compartmentalize, make things into fundable projects, and you bite off pieces you can chew. You know, when we're looking at, you know, 7 to 9 million to complete housing, that's doable.
Housing is in high demand in Mahtarvik. At least 6 homes are slated for completion during this summer's construction season. but the community needs 49 homes to fully house everyone who needs to move from Newtok.
So the purpose of our meeting tonight is to provide you with an update on construction.
After a full day of government-to-government meetings with federal agencies, members of the Newtok Village Council and the steering committee also met with community members who now live in Makhtarvet.
We want to have a really open discussion about some of the concerns that you might have or questions that you have related to relocation.
Frida Carl made the trip across the river to attend the meeting. In her indigenous language, Yuchtun, she raised concerns about the division that's developing as people slowly move out of Newtok and into Makhtarvik. Carl says she's looking forward to the community coming back together as one again. Her husband, Philip, a council member, reminded tribal leadership about their responsibility to use the latest infusion of federal funding wisely. Carl also says the council has the right to make decisions about how federal funding that comes to his tribe is spent. He urged council members to make decisions to prioritize sanitation and waste management to keep the new village site at Makhtarvik clean and healthy. Reporting in Makhtarvik, I'm Emily Schwing.
From January through this April, more than a dozen red foxes in the Nome area have shown signs of rabies and tested positive for the virus. KNOM's Greg Knight has the story.
According to Alaska Department of Fish and Game wildlife veterinarian Dr. Kimberly Beckman, during a typical winter, there are usually only two or three positive rabies cases from the Nome area.
There's been 16 total red foxes, if you count Nome and the surrounding area, plus there was one each in Unalakleet, Shishmaref, and today we diagnosed one in Brevig Mission.
That case in Brevig Mission was diagnosed on Wednesday, April 26th. Preliminary 2023 results already show differences from samples taken 2 years ago. Of 11 foxes this year that were found dead or killed in Nome by dogs, or because they appeared rabid, all were positive for the virus. Of the 61 red foxes counted in and around Nome between February and March of this year, nearly one quarter were positive. That's an increase over the 17% of positive foxes during a similar period in 2021. This year, the Centers for Disease Control donated BioNote rabies test kits to the state. Beckman says that with those kits, officials can confirm in minutes if rabies is present in fox brain tissue, rather than the hours it previously required.
Even if the fox was, shot in the head and there's no recognizable brain left, if it's positive, we can get that positive result right away and make sure that the dog or person that was exposed is notified right away so they get the appropriate treatment and boosters.
If someone believes they've been exposed to rabies, they're advised to seek immediate medical attention. Beckman says dog-to-human infection by the rabies virus after a dog has encountered a rabid fox is of concern if infection goes unnoticed.
We have had cases even this winter where a red fox has attacked a person, but most of the time the people recognize that this is not a good thing and they seek medical care. Whereas if a dog gets attacked by a fox or tangles with a fox and people don't know it, and then the dog becomes rabid and then bites the person, then that's an unknown exposure, so the person doesn't get treated.
According to NSHC, no cases of rabies in humans has been detected since January. Beckman says if Western Alaskans see a fox acting aggressively or afraid, or trembling or having what looks to be seizures and aggressively biting at an inanimate object, the best advice is to put it down.
If they see a fox like that, then they should shoot it and submit it to Fish and Game.
Norton Sound Health Corporation provides a regional vaccination program. Alicia Wright is an environmental health specialist for NSHC, which trains vaccinators to work with dogs and cats in villages.
We have one in almost every village who can vaccinate for rabies, and it's free for anybody who wants to get vaccinated. We do have lay vaccinators in Nome that we have trained through Norton Sound Environmental Health.
Wright added that keeping dog food and garbage away from foxes helps to limit their presence in towns and villages. Making sure pets are always supervised or tied up and unable to interact with potentially rabid foxes is another important factor. Reporting in Nome, I'm Greg Knight.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
Anchorage officials have set aside more than $800,000 to pay legal settlements related to accusations against the Bronson administration of wrongful termination in a contractor dispute. The Anchorage Assembly approved settlement money in budget revisions Tuesday. City officials say the money will go to potentially as many as three settlements, but have not specified amounts. The wrongful termination allegations are from Mayor Dave Bronson's former municipal manager, Amy Domboski, as well as Heather McAlpine, former director of the city's Office of Equal Opportunity. Roger Hickel Contracting is also suing the city for work on a proposed navigation center and homeless shelter, a controversial project the assembly halted. Municipal attorney Ann Helzer says the administration plans on presenting more information on the settlements during a May 5th executive session, with hopes to move forward with the payments by May 9th. Alaska's mariculture industry was awarded $49 million in federal funding last year to develop the state's burgeoning kelp market. Now, industry leaders are looking across the Pacific Ocean for inspiration on how to keep the state's kelp scene growing. KMXD's Kirsten Dobroth reports.
Nick Mangini is a kelp farmer and mariculture director for the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference. He was in South Korea earlier this month touring kelp farms and processing facilities. Asian countries, including South Korea, make up the bulk of the world's kelp market.
Every time I go to a conference or something where it's all mariculture-related business people, whether that be farmers or industry, you kind of get this buzz and everybody gets excited, and it's what keeps us going right now.
Mangini and his colleagues are looking to countries like South Korea for inspiration as Alaska overcomes well-documented hurdles in its own budding industry. For one, the state has a processing gap when it comes to kelp. That's where Mangini says the South Korean farmers have a big advantage.
They bring in the kelp and hand lay it out in a field and let it air dry, where we don't have that climate that would allow that, number one, and the rules through the FDA are just going to be way too stringent to make something like that happen.
Mangini says many kelp farms in South Korea also use seaweed and shellfish cultivation in tandem to maximize their crop.
70% of the species of kelp that's the most similar to what I grow comes straight off a farm and goes straight into an abalone culture to feed the abalone year-round.
The South Korean visit was sponsored by the World Wildlife Fund and included other kelp farmers and processors from North America and Europe. Mangini says connecting with them was just as informative as meeting with the trip's South Korean hosts.
Bouncing ideas off each other, talking about the design of our farms, the way that they process in New England, possibilities for future collaborations with people from the East Coast and the West Coast, people from Canada and Alaska, even into Europe.
Mangini was one of Alaska's first kelp farmers. He put in his application for a plot by Near Island, right near the city of Kodiak, in 2016, and harvested his first crop the year after that. Two other people started out the same year as him. It's taken off since then, and just last year, Alaska kelp farmers harvested 650,000 pounds of seaweed. That's a tiny fraction compared to South Korea's production, but Mangini says Alaska's mariculture industry has the potential to be a leader by volume, just like its finfish fisheries. He says another big step is getting commercial fishermen to see the industry's value as a source of income in between fishing seasons.
I would just hope that we could work together and they could see this as an opportunity for them to use their boats or even, you know, have their own farms in the future.
Mangini says with federal funds on the way, there's real momentum for the industry in the state. He's hopeful lessons learned from the trip will help ease some of the growing pains. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Sitka celebrated its fourth annual Yakuik, or herring ceremony, this month. The ceremony honors the role of herring in the way of life of the Tlingit people. The event included stories performed in Tlingit and English, distribution of gifts and blankets, and traditional song and dance. KCAW's Meredith Reddick attended the event and returned with this audio postcard.
The doors of Akahit, the Point House, are open.
The doors of Kachachahit, Jumping Herring House or Shattering House, are open.
Can you tell me your name?
Bob Sam. I grew up here in Sitka, in the village of Sitka. What's so incredible now is our young people are picking it up and taking it into the future. But what's more incredible is they're wearing their regalia in their everyday life. And I dreamed of this.
Yolanda.
My favorite part is watching the elders, you know, reconnect with culture that they may not have participated in for a long time. So seeing the joy in their faces.
They were amazed. No one had come near his daughter. What happened?
Gaudeya kanda hitwe tokani ye kakwa uwu. Aka chash hit the wewu dutli yech. Gank.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Emily Schwing in Muktarvik, Greg Knight in Nome, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Kirsten Dobrath in Kodiak, and Meredith Reddick in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Emmer, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.